Welcome to the NLP View with your host, Donna Blinspin. Each week, Donna will explore how the techniques of NLP can help improve your personal and professional life. And now, here's your host, Donna Blinspin.
Hello, and welcome to the NLP View. My name is Donna Blinspin. Today's guest is the inspiring Dr. Richard Gray, author of the best-selling book about addictions, Notes from Psychology, Neuroscience, and NLP. About Addictions provides a perspective for clear thinking about what to do rather than how to feel about addiction and addiction spectrum disorders. Dr. Richard Gray provides the reader with data from psychology, neuroscience, and neurolinguistic programming, NLP, looking at the nature of addictions and the structure of motivations for change. He provides techniques and perspectives from NLP to suggest some novel approaches to treating the problem. NLP allows you to make changes at all levels of the mind, looking at areas that control your instinctive habits, your beliefs, and your behaviors. When the addiction connects to negative thoughts and beliefs from a person's past, for example, NLP can remove the negative associations that have been attached to those memories. If the addiction provides an escape from stress, anxiety, or from an unfulfilled life, then NLP can help set goals that can push aside the need for escaping. So I'd like to welcome to the show Dr. Richard Gray. Hello, Dr. Gray.
Hello. How are you, Donna?
I am brilliant, thank you. Really good. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
And before I start, I just want to thank you for joining me today on the show. It's a true honor to have you as my guest today.
Well, I'm honored in return. This is a treat for me. As I said before, I love to talk, and I love an audience.
Well, I mean, as you know, and our listeners will know now, that alongside my NLP consultancy, I work as a specialist in bloodborne viruses. So I treat patients with Hep B, Hep C, HIV. And amongst my patient group, a good half of them are XIV drug users with addictive spectrum disorders. So this field that you work in and that you've studied and provided the science a science to attach to the NLP is so fundamentally important to me, both professionally within my nursing role, but also with my private clients that I coach. It's given me new ways of looking at how I can support them, new options, and it's that whole the curiosity around it, and it's not just helped me, but the colleagues that I work with and that I've shared your book with, it's helped develop them professionally. So I want to just thank you as much as anything else.
Well, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. And well, before we start discussing your work, could you tell our audience about yourself?
Well, right now I'm a professor in the School of Criminal Justice at Fairleigh Dickinson University in New Jersey in the USA. Before that, for 21 years, I was a United States probation officer in the U.S. courts in Brooklyn, New York. While there, for 10 years, I did nothing but treat substance abusers of various kinds, from casual users to serious addicts. And several years into that program, into that job, using NLP skills, I realized that we had tools that we could use much more efficiently than the ways the government was then wasting money on treating addictions. And so we created the Brooklyn program. And we ran several hundred people through it at massive savings of money. And we got 30% abstinence, 29.6%. Abstinence after a year after completing the program, and that was with about 2 hours of my time per week. So that says something about the effectiveness of NLP.
Wow, that's a credit to you. How did you come about NLP yourself?
Time Magazine. In the early 80s, there was an article about Time Magazine, about NLP in Time Magazine. And it spoke about a few techniques. One was rapport, and the other was talking to the part. And I said, well, let me try this. And I had a client who was connected to the mafia, and we had never really talked about anything. And I began doing rapport exactly as it was described in Time magazine, mirroring his posture, mirroring his race. And suddenly he forgets that I'm his probation officer. Yeah. And he starts to talk about how stupid the feds are and begins to give me information that nobody had. He walks out. I call up the FBI and give them the information. And sure enough, it's accurate. They're able to change the nature of their investigation. Another guy came in, and just a very sweet man who was an artist. And he had had really a phobic avoidance of art galleries, because when his art gallery went sour, he decided the only way he could refinance it was by importing cocaine. And of course, he got caught.
Okay.
And I was really interested in getting this man to get back into the gallery business, because he was a very talented artist. And so I sat him in a corner and I said, "You shut up. I want to talk to that part." I began to talk to the part responsible for his not going to working in the galleries, and essentially did a six-step reframe without knowing what I was doing. And don't you know, within a month or so, he had gotten a job in a gallery and was adjusting very well. I was convinced from that point. When I went to take my PhD a few years later, they wanted us to study something besides our main topic. Mine was Jungian theory. And I chose NLP. I said, "Here's my excuse." And I took practitioner and master practitioner training.
Wow. That experience that you had is very similar to along the lines of mine. And the parts reframe that you talk about is one technique that I use a lot with my clients, but particularly it was one of the things that really enabled me to see and feel the power of NLP and the respectfulness about it, because it enables you to get into that other person's world. When I took my current role within healthcare, if I step back, I've been very much brought up, wrapped up in cotton wool, quite naive to that side of the world. However, my passion and my speciality, which is in the liver and gastroenterology, is what brought me into the bloodborne viruses role. With that comes the substance misuse world, which I was completely naive to. And if it weren't for the NLP, I wouldn't be able to build that rapport. I wouldn't be able to respect their model world, because it's a model world that's so different from a world that I was brought up in. And seeing that power that it's got, and that the grace that there is there about it, it's powerful.
Wonderful. Yes, very. And grace is a wonderful world, straight out of Gregory Bateson's idea that when we unleash the power of our unconscious and rest down into grace, as trusting our own deep selves to lead us in a positive direction. That's part of the essence, I think, of NLP. I often quote Milton Erickson saying that he would never presume to tell the unconscious what to do. He just tells it the direction and trusts it. And,
a brilliant quote.
He was a brilliant man, and we would do well to listen more to him. My interest in addictions, first of all, comes from my own life experience. I come from a family of alcoholics. I had my own drug problems in the 60s. But when I finished my PhD, I had been doing a special assignment as the computer guy, and they said, "You have to go back to doing regular casework." And they gave me a drug caseload. And I said, "Well, what do I do with this?" I had Jungian theory and I had NLP. And I began to realize that the two fit together. Jung provided a structure about how to think about change, and more about transformative change than anything else. And NLP provided a set of tools that I understood that we could use to change people's experience. If you consider that one of the big pieces of addiction is that it's the best thing that's ever happened to them in their current experience, and it biases their whole nervous system so that every other kind of reinforcement or engagement is lessened in its impact. The first question that came to my mind: how can we give somebody a set of experiences that will be intrinsically more valuable, more intuitive, and more accessible than the drugs. And of course, that comes right out of reframing by Grinder and Bandler. Yeah, that's a direct quote from them. And that question stayed with me. And it occurred to me that if we could awaken people to a deep sense of their purpose, that would go a long way towards changing their whole connection to the world. And, of course, that also changes the nature of addiction treatment from being an ill-formed, according to NLP, enterprise, to being a well-formed enterprise. And one of the great insights to me from NLP is the idea of a well-formed outcome. It must be stated in the positive. It must be under your personal control. It must be sensory specific. It must be ecological. And then you have to be able to step into it and describe how you got there. Well, when we approach drugs, we start off by telling people, don't do that.
Yeah.
But that's no way to get to an outcome, okay? And by their own experience, not doing drugs is something that they can't do.
Yeah.
And so there was another groundbreaking piece of information that I came across from James Prochaska, who with Norcross and DiClemente were the founders of the Stages of Change model. And I don't know if, and I know you're aware of it, I don't know if your listeners are, but this is one of the most well-used models of change that there is, scientifically validated. And people pass from what in addictions we used to call denial, and that's just pre-contemplation. They don't even know there's a problem half the time, to contemplation, thinking about a problem, to preparation, to making some kinds of movement towards change, to action, actually doing something about it, and then maintenance, and finally, which addictions people don't like to talk about, termination. It's no longer a problem, and the person is no longer connected to it. James Prochaska says in several papers, and in the middle of the book, Changing for Good, he says this. He says, one night he awakened and he realized that there was some commonality among all the people who had made significant changes. And he went down and he went through articles and articles and charts and charts. And he said this, he said, the one thing that differentiated the people who were successful at change from the people that weren't was this. They had all identified something in their life that was more important to them than drugs, okay, or alcohol, or whatever the change was. The light went on for me. It connected up with the Jungian idea of calling, and I said, my goodness, the well-formed outcome is going to be one of the central pieces in getting people to change. And he also showed this. He said that trying to convince people that it's not good doesn't work. But when they have the outcome, when they know what they want, they immediately begin to devalue the problem behavior because it gets in the way of what they want. It's pure NLP. Prochaska had no idea it was pure NLP, but that's a crucial piece. Well-formed outcomes are powerful, and that was really one of the heart pieces of the program.
That's the biggest part that I play with my clients when I'm working with them and their addiction is that well-formed outcome side. And half of it is because the substance misuse problem or behavior that they have is their go-to resource. It's their way. It's their get-out clause. And the thing is, that's their strategy for coping with the stresses, the whatever's going on in their life. And every time they turn to drugs, they get the result they want to get.
Exactly right. And we're not allowed to say that, are we? We're not allowed to say
that. No, that's wrong.
It works. It works for them immediately.
It works perfectly. It does. And, you know, it's that whole essence of NLP, of how people do the best with the resources that they've got available to them. Drugs is a resource that's available to them and that they know how to do. And because they've got wrapped up in that world, and it's not just the world of drugs for them as an individual, it's a whole community of life. It's their social, their peer group, their friends, their community that they live in. It's the only knowing of being that they're used to. And it's that whole, even if you take the drugs away from that person, you're still putting them back into that same bedsit with the same social neighbours and friends, the same problems, the same stresses. And that's one of my issues that I have with healthcare, is that,
you know, the Alcoholics Anonymous, for example, a lot of my work prior to this role was with alcoholics. And a lot of their, you know, we bring them into hospital, they withdraw, we do the whole detox with them. We then send them out without the alcohol, which is their identity of self, and put them back into the same home that they were in, that caused, that had the problems in the first place, and tell them to go and self-refer to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, they need, they live off that social reinforcement. They need that peer group, that social bonding, that group support. And if you've missed out that step and you've put them back home to where their troubles lie in their world, what are we doing? What are we doing?
Yeah, we're doing that. No. The other piece of that is that if we speak to their core, which NLP is capable of doing, and awaken a direction that allows them to discover who they are and what all of their biology and neurology has been calling them to do since the day before they were born, okay? Mm-hmm. If we put them on that track, then what I've seen happening fairly consistently is people waking up in the middle of that and saying, hey, I don't want this anymore. I want a different life. And maybe they get divorced, maybe they move away, but they begin to build a brand new life. And that's one of the crucial things. We want to speak to people's hearts to the point where they find out what is best for them. Interesting study. Some years ago in Connecticut here in the U.S., the VA did a massive study of alcoholics. They had found that naltrexone worked very well with heroin addicts and had shown great promise in dealing with alcoholics, just by blocking the urge and blocking the feeling that comes from drinking. Well, they did this huge study, and as you just said, the people walked back into their environments, and lo and behold, no sooner were they off in the naltrexone, but they were right back drinking. Why? Yeah. Their whole lives were centered around drinking. They didn't know what else to do, and they hadn't dealt with the real problem.
That's where a lot of your work and my work and other people as well, is it's that those intrinsic personal goals, that identifying with the sense of self, the sense of being, the who are they? And that, you know, it's that question as well that you ask of, you know, what would you want to be instead? Who else are you? And they don't know. And that's a huge big, you know, excuse the French, but it's a big slap in the face of some people.
Sure.
And half the time, because nobody's ever asked them, because people aren't interested, because they see them as the alcoholic, as the drug addict. They don't see the person behind, because it's that whole self-fulfilling prophecy, isn't it? They become what they're stereotyped to be, because sometimes it's just easier to be what they're meant to be rather than try and work it out for themselves.
Yeah, yeah. Pure labeling theory stands up and shouts at you from that. One of the striking things about finding that direction, that developmental path, comes from a story. I used to be the probation officer of the last resort. Anybody who was too crazy for anybody else to come to, anybody who was too seriously addicted to get any results elsewhere, well, they ended up giving it to me. And I got this ex-mafia lawyer. That's one of my favorite stories again. And this guy had been a rabid threatening, shouting machine. He came into the office, would disrupt it all the time. Well, finally he got hooked on coke, had a serious habit. They had sent him to every treatment they could, and they didn't want to put him in jail because they knew lawsuits and trouble would come out of it. So they finally brought him to me. And at that point, the one thing that came to mind, this is along those same lines, Richard Bandler says, ask. And I said, okay. I said, Charlie, what do you need to have in your life in order for this not to be a problem anymore?
Yeah.
He said, well, I know, but I can't tell you. I said, ah. So we worked on it. We used NLP tools. We used MetaModel, and we used reframing and everything else. And after about a month, he says, well, I'll tell you. When I was a kid, when I was a little boy, I always wanted to be a priest in the Catholic Church. I was an altar boy, and it meant so much to me that I know if I ever went back to church, my life would be changed. And so we began to meta-model that and work with that. And again, after a month, he had been to confession. Another week, and he'd been to the Eucharist. Within another month, he had stopped using all together. And as far as I know, 1996. He has been clean ever since. And this was someone with an uncontrollable cocaine habit.
Wow.
But he found the thing that would give his life meaning. And that without imputing any supernatural meaning to that all, it's simply the fact that we all have a core towards which we're meaning and moving. And sometimes no one ever asks us, or we never stop to think for ourselves. And just a little push sometimes in the right direction, like the butterfly effect, can cascade into entire life changes. Other times we have to do other things. And one of the things that we did in the program, part of the way we got to helping people find their outcome, their life meaning, was to teach them how to control their emotions. You know, in NLP, one of the things that we do is we do submodality analysis, the small dimensions of sensory experience. How big is it? How bright is it? How close is it? How loud is it? What's the timbre of the sound? What's the texture of the feeling? Where is the feeling? And I never promised, we never associated our program with addiction. As soon as people were sent there, we said, this is the last time we're going to talk about addiction, and never talked about it again. I promised them three things. We're going to teach you three things in the program. One, how to feel better every day. Two, how to control your emotions. And three, how to turn them on and off whenever you want. And so we taught them how to take a simple memory, crank it up by making it bigger, closer, louder, okay? And people would jump out of their chairs. Oh, I didn't know I could do this. And then we would teach them to anchor that. So that, which is really a basic conditioned response, so they could push a button, they could put their fingers together, and that feeling would come up, and it would change their mood, it would change their attitude, and it would change their whole perception of what was going on. Another favorite story that comes out of that time is I had a guy, he was a multiple bank robber. He had been violated on parole several times. The guy looked like he was going to spend his career either in jail or on supervision. And he was in the program, and he was skeptical but cooperative. He was a nice guy. And one day he comes to me, the I think it was the week after we learned the first two anchors. He came back and he says, Dr. Gray, I've got a problem. I said, what's the matter? He said, well, I went to the place where I usually buy my drugs. And I said, yeah. He says, well, I said, what happened? He said, I got confused. I didn't know what to do. And I said, so what did you do? He said, I left. We never had another positive urine from the guy. Just being able to feel good was enough to turn this person's perspective inside out. And he began to do very well.
Anchoring and submodalities are personal favorites of mine. And I know with one of the things around anchoring, I had only recently, actually, a lady that I've been working with for some time, and she's abstained from drugs. She's doing really well. A hugely intelligent lady. She's just beautiful to see her develop into, you know, into herself. But when we first started looking at anchoring, how is it she wanted to feel? She wanted to feel free, and that was a reason why she wanted to feel free from her life stresses, but free from pain. And she had a lot of spinal problems and sciatica pains. So we looked at that feeling, and a lot of it was the freedom from pain, and that she was chasing with the drugs. So opiates is how she got into drugs, and that led her down the path of more addictive heroines and et cetera. When I worked with her around, we looked at installing an anchor so that she could get that state of freedom, that sense of a higher self is what she was wanting, and that peace and tranquility within herself. And just by having that, once we'd applied it, she just broke down into pieces. Because she thought she could only ever get that through drugs, and she thought she was going to be a dirty drug addict, which was her model of the world, because that was the only way she could achieve what she needed. And just by giving that to her my purpose was just there in front of me. It was wonderful.
Oh, that's wonderful. Wonderful. There's a Jungian analyst from Italy. His name is Luigi Zoia, and he wrote a book called Addiction and Initiation. And his point that for many addicts, the problem is they're looking for transcendence, and they make the mistake of looking for it in a pill or something you smoke or something you shoot up. And they're looking for that powerful experience, and they can't find it. And sometimes just giving someone that option changes everything. In the language of neuroscience, one of the things that we strive to do is to give people an experience that is more salient. It is more craved than the drug experience. What drugs do is they work on the midbrain dopamine system, among others. And for some addicts, not all of them, but for some, the most important part is they can't even imagine something as good as drugs once they've had them. And the whole system gets biased to prefer drugs. And sometimes just giving them that option. I have a good friend up in New York State, had a woman who was an intractable alcoholic. She was her family was falling apart. She was able to do her duties in the family for the years, but she would always end the day with a blackout. And nothing they could do in terms of standard treatment helped her. And this person called me and said, what can we do? And I said, why don't you start off by teaching her how to anchor some positive affect? And don't you know, are we still here? Hello?
Yes, we're still here.
Okay, I'm sorry. I hear the Skyping in the background. And don't you know, after a little practice with that, her craving and her drinking stopped. Sometimes it is very simple things, like giving people, as you said, the resources that they need to do what they want to do or to feel the way they need to feel. Other people, it's got to be more than that. For some people, some recent research focuses on the fact that many addicts have problems with their frontal inhibitory circuits. That's the frontal lobe, the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, the anterior cingulate. And that those circuits tend to be co-opted by drugs, and they don't, get their fair share of the neurotransmitters that would keep them functioning. Actually, the number of receptors decreases. And they found that mental exercise can help change that, getting people to think. And I take that as a validation of the submodality exercises. You learn to concentrate. You learn to focus your attention on feeling good. You learn to focus your attention on how good you can feel and where you want to be. That reawakens those circuits so that you can begin to make choices in other parts of your life. So there are all of these wonderful kinds of connections that I still see coming out of neuroscience every time I look.
It's an amazing field, and the more advances that are happening and the more research, it opens up even more possibilities, which we could just keep on talking. We could go on and on and on. It's an amazing field, and I can't believe we're coming towards the end, Richard, and I want to make sure that people know about you, how they can get in contact with you, your book, your work, and all your details for our listeners, please.
Okay, well, my website, the easy way to get to my website is tinyurl.com, tinyurl.com/ Richard Rick Gray, RickGray, and that will give you my website. There are links on my front page to get to my books. All of them can be downloaded for free from the Lulu site. Download the PDF. If you want to buy hard copy, that's available there too. The other web address is richardmgray.home.comcast.net, but tiny URL will get there too. One more is if you want to contact me, you can contact me at rmgray, G-R-A-Y, 2012, @gmail.com.
Brilliant, Richard. And thank you ever so much for joining me today. Your work is wonderful. It empowers me and my job, and I'm looking forward to speaking to you again on a personal and professional level to learn even more. And I want to thank all of our listeners today for tuning in. If you'd like to learn more about NLP, then please tune in each week and also visit my website, which is www.nlp.com. donnablinston.com, where you can pick up a copy of my best-selling book, which is Psychobabble, a straightforward, plain English guide to the benefits of NLP. Thank you for tuning in.